Your Honors. Thank you very much. Your Honors, in this case, both the immigration judge and the board found that petitioner was ineligible for asylum and withholding of removal on the grounds that she was a member of and supported a non-designated terrorist organization, namely the Eritrean Liberation Front. As a result of this finding, she was basically found ineligible for asylum and withholding removal, and the only relief available to her after that was the very limited form of relief known as deferral of removal under the Torture Convention. But both the board and the IJ found that she was not eligible for that relief either because she didn't demonstrate her...
I guess what I'm concerned about, Mr. Matthew, did she exhaust the argument that she can't be removed on terrorism grounds before the BIA?
Yes, she did, because she challenged the finding of the BIA, of the judge, that the ELF was a terrorist organization. She may not have made those...
But I'm talking about, right now, she's made a lot of arguments, and at least right. By my reading of it, many of the arguments are new. And I'm troubled. I mean, so that she raised the terrorism issue in a general sense, I understand. But
right.
My concern is it appears that she's made a number of the arguments that you're undoubtedly bringing to us today. She did not bring those to the BIA, and if it's not exhausted, we don't have jurisdiction on those points, do we?
Well, the Ninth Circuit has held many times that petitioner before the board doesn't have to make the most articulate arguments in a case before the BIA in
but
order for it to
But the petitioner has to exhaust his or her administrative remedies.
She does, and she has. She did question the designation of the ELF as a terrorist organization in her BIA brief.
If hypothetically... we felt there were no exhaustion. What should we do? Remand it to the BIA so they can consider her arguments in the first instance?
I would think that would be fair and in the interest of justice, and it should be at least remanded also for the question of deferral of removal, because I believe that she does certainly qualify for deferral of removal under the facts of the case. And also it should be remanded to the board because... the way the case has proceeded, she's basically being denied her opportunity to be considered for a waiver. And the Congress specifically created waivers for because they realized the injustice of this kind of situation where somebody was a member of an organization long term.
I understand it, though. The waiver under Section 1182D3BI is invested solely with the Secretary of Homeland Security in consultation with the Attorney General and the Secretary of State, and it says in such Secretary's sole unreviewable discretion. Under those circumstances, do we have any basis for reviewing that aspect of this case?
Well, I think, because the board, neither the board nor the IJ made a finding of whether she would be eligible for asylum but for the terrorism bars, I think there is grounds for removal and remand on that basis.
Okay, and I understand your point on the first issue we talked about, but I'm talking about under the section that I just cited, which I won't bother with reciting again.
Right.
It seems to me we're just out of luck there. We don't have any jurisdiction if it's unreviewable. The statute's very clear. It's unreviewable.
And I'm not asking you guys to, this court, to make a finding regarding the waiver. I'm not asking the court to make say that she should be granted a waiver. I'm just saying that there should be an opportunity for her to be considered by the Secretary of State in his...
But you're saying we have jurisdiction to send it back so that the Secretary can do her job.
I am saying that there is... that the proper procedure was not followed here. That she should have been, for she, despite the terrorism bars, the board and the immigration judge should have made a finding regarding her.
If we do send it back, to who do we send it? If it's unreviewable, would the IJ have jurisdiction? Would the BIA have jurisdiction?
They would not, but the current DHS policy is that for cases before the immigration judge, they would be put on hold for the Secretary of State and the appropriate authorities to consider a waiver.
Counsel, Judge Gould, if I could ask you a question. Did your client ask the board to do that earlier?
Well,
did your client ask the BIA, wait a minute, don't rule on this, submit this to the secretary for a waiver determination?
Well, the waiver, particular waiver provision for her type of case was not established into law until 2008. And at that time, her case had already been up in front of this court. It had already been appealed to this court.
Okay, thanks.
Excuse me, I want to be sure I understood you correctly. Are you saying, in answer to Judge Gould's question, that before the BIA considered this, that this was in fact considered by the secretary?
No, I'm saying there wasn't a waiver available for
her. You're saying the waiver
this case
provision,
was before, huh?
As I understand, you're saying when she argued to the BIA, this waiver provision did not exist.
Yes, exactly.
And it was subsequently enacted. So you'd like us to remand so the BIA can address it.
When was it enacted?
It was enacted at the end of December 2007. And this case was on appeal since 2006 here. And Your Honors, if I may also address the issue of the sufficiency of the evidence. The evidence, basically the government's position would be that an immigration judge can just rely on any evidence pulled off from the Internet in order to hold that an organization meets the definition of a Tier 3 terrorist organization without any guarantors of reliability or trustworthiness of that evidence.
There's no question that this organization was a terrorist organization, is there? Wasn't it specifically named?
Was it? It hasn't been designated by...
It has not been designated.
No, it's a Tier 3 terrorist organization, which means it's
okay,
a non-designated.
Okay, but counsel, if I could ask you this. I understand, like, one person's terrorist is another person's freedom fighter, so I'm not being judgmental on this. But I thought that the petitioner herself testified that the ELF, in struggling to let Eritrea break away from Ethiopia, engaged in various kinds of violent acts, including blowing up an hijacking an airplane, assassinations, and other, you know, violent conduct. So if that was from her testimony, which is how I read the IJ's opinion, then it's not really a case of saying the IJ can drag anything off the Internet. I thought the IJ relied in large part on how she described the organization herself.
No, in fact, the IJ relied solely, and the same as the board relied on Exhibit 11, which are the those incident profiles from the Internet. And in fact,
was the IJ to disregard her testimony that the ELF was ELF's objective was the forcible overthrow of the government of Ethiopia, and a factor that Judge Gould outlined?
Well, the name solely stating that the ELF was engaged in armed struggle against the Ethiopian government does not necessarily mean it engaged in terrorist activities. If you look at the statutory definition of what constitutes a terrorist activity, they're very discreet acts: hijacking, kidnapping, and violent attacks.
But she specifically said she knew or thought that the organization had hijacked an airplane, did she not?
She did not say that. She said she heard about it, but she did not know anything about it. It's hard to understand what she's trying to say. It's a very ambiguous.
Well, this is the material assistance issue as well. I mean, it's a very broad net. One can agree or not agree with what Congress decided to do, but it's a very, very broad net. And the fact that she, as Judge Marbley indicated, the fact that she, if you will, confessed, she volunteered the fact that she was aware of this hijacking and other actions trying to violently overthrow the government, doesn't that leave her in an untenable position?
Well, like I said, her testimony is very vague, and it's almost like if she's saying, I heard about it.
Her testimony is not vague on those points, though. My question is, isn't that testimony a sufficient basis from which the IJ can make the decision that ELF was a terrorist organization?
Because she's almost saying, I heard about it, but it's not true. It's nothing that I know of. It's almost like she's saying it's not true. Well, What is one possible interpretation of what she said?
That would be a real stretch.
Well, she says nothing that I know of. Like, and when did she know about it? If she didn't know about it at the time she joined, or did she know about it several years later after she
left? Right, but that might be arguable, counsel, about the hijacking of the plane. But I thought she also testified about other types of violent activities that she definitely knew about. Is that...
No.
Is that wrong?
In fact, that would be wrong. In fact, the DHS attorney asked her specifically about the other incidents in the MIPT profiles, and she said she knew nothing about them.
Well, I know she didn't know about all the things in those documents that were in the exhibit, but I thought she described the organization in terms that indicated knowledge it had used violent techniques. And I'll go back and reread all her testimony.
You were right, Judge Gould. I mean, she said that, did your group use violence? Yes, they did. They were fighting for the independence of Eritrea, that they used weapons. Yes, they had a gun and so on and so forth. So if you look at the record, 146, 194 to 195, 229, 233, and 239. My point is that could the judge rely on this testimony? You go into the merits of whether it's true, whether she meant it, whether it was vague. Could he rely on this testimony in making a decision that the ELF is a terrorist organization?
I don't believe he can, and the reason is violence itself does not qualify as a terrorist activity. Again,
well, but a terrorist activity under 1182A3B III I says that the use of any explosive or firearm with the intent to endanger directly or indirectly the safety of one or more individuals or to cause substantial damage to property, that is under the definition of terrorist activity. So if you take her testimony in the context of that definition, why can't the IJ rely on that testimony to find that there was terrorist activity?
Where is the demonstration of intent in that statement, that there was an intent to endanger property or people?
Well, she doesn't have to have intent. She has to materially support it, does she not?
Well, we're talking about whether ELF qualifies as a terrorist organization. And for that, you need to present specific incidents of specific attacks that meet that definition of a terrorist organization, of a terrorist activity. And I also point out that even this court in Khan noted that if a country has been a signatory to Geneva Conventions, then that would be incorporated into their domestic law, the international law of armed conflict. And so it's simply a statement that violence against a government would not necessarily be unlawful under that country's...
But here, isn't
there... But she wasn't... I'm sorry, go ahead, Judge.
No, please, go ahead. Go.
What I was going to say was, at the time she's describing ELF, it was not a government. It was, as I understand it, an organization trying to extract Eritrea from within the government of Ethiopia. So I don't see how your Geneva Convention argument follows it. To me it has no traction to say, well, a government can, like during World War II, England and France and the U.S. could use violence and that wouldn't be terrorist, but a group trying to break away a segment of a country to be a separate country doesn't come within the definition. I'm having the same trouble I think Judge Marpley was addressing. The question for us isn't, do we think, would we find on the evidence that ELF qualifies? The question is there substantial evidence in the record from which the administrative agency could make that decision? And I think that test by Supreme Court doctrine requires us to ask, does the record compel the opposite conclusion? So to say there wasn't substantial evidence that they qualify would be to say the record compels the conclusion that they don't qualify. Do I have the test right?
Well, if that evidence is admissible, yes, then that would be the MIPT evidence. If that evidence is admissible, if it doesn't violate fundamental fairness, then I would agree that that would be the test. And in regards to the Geneva Conventions issue, the Geneva Conventions includes all parties to armed conflict, not just governments. So basically, Ethiopia, and it was a signatory to the Geneva Conventions starting in 1977, that way, and by being a signatory, it incorporated the law of international armed conflict into its domestic law. Therefore, lawful attacks against military targets by a group like ELF would not be considered unlawful under its own law, and therefore would not meet the definition of a terrorist activity.
Mr. Matthew, we're taking you a little over time. We'll give you a little bit to respond afterwards. Why don't we hear from the government, and then we'll come back to you for a brief response. Mr. Stone?
Good afternoon. May it please the Court. My name is Paul Stone. I represent the Respondent, Attorney General of the United States. This petition for review involves a woman who described herself as an urban warrior for the ELF, a group dedicated to the violent overthrow of the Ethiopian government. She admitted the hijacked aircraft, and she passed on information to the that would help them target the government.
Did she actually admit to participating in the hijacking, or did she simply say she had heard about the hijacking?
She just said she heard about it, Your Honor. We're not accusing her of having been involved in the hijacking, but she did.
Well, where does the evidence come from that says she helped ELF target officials or people in the Ethiopian government or military? What was that her own testimony or someone else's?
That comes both from her testimony and from the letter she introduced from the ELF.
Where's that in the record?
Yes, the letter from the ELF is at page 470 in the record, and the testimony from her can be found at page 232. Where she testified that she carried information. She didn't know the exact contents of the information, but she understood that it would be used to attack or target the government of Ethiopia. And the letter from the ELF corroborated that, explaining that she collected information on the enemy. Now what's important about that point is that that renders her inadmissible under little paragraph 3, that's 1182A3BVIIII. Sorry for the alphabet soup.
What's the government's position regarding the failure to exhaust the argument that she can't be removed on terrorism grounds? You agree that she didn't exhaust, or do you think she did?
Well, on the particular grounds she raised below, she did.
So you think we have jurisdiction and we have no issue of exhaustion?
Well, there are various other issues. There's various areas that she didn't exhaust.
What did she not exhaust?
For example, she didn't raise a coherent objection to the immigration judge to the introduction of the MIPT reports. She essentially put in a placeholder objection saying, I object, which more or less is saying, I object. This is devastating to my case.
That's it?
I'll think of the reason later.
That's it?
That's all she put towards that.
Counsel, on that issue, let me ask this. Generally, at least some agencies regularly consider hearsay evidence they think is reliable. We don't have a Ninth Circuit or Supreme Court rule, do we, that says the BIA or an IJ can never consider hearsay, nor do we?
No, Your Honor. To the opposite, the court has a rule that hearsay evidence is admissible in immigration courts. In particular, as long as it doesn't violate the alien's due process. And in this case, there's no indication the MIPT reports do, aside from the fact that there was no coherent objection raised below. And the reason that's so important is because that's the opportunity for the trial judge to fix the problem.
Was she counseled at that time?
Yes, she had counsel, Your Honor. And it's the opportunity for the other party to correct the problem.
Can the alien submit hearsay evidence as well as the government?
Absolutely.
Is it a two-way street?
Aliens do all the time. Typically, the bulk of an alien's evidence is hearsay evidence. Things like declarations from people in their home countries, reports from the State Department, things like that. So in immigration court, it's typical.
I want to ask you a little bit about the statute concerning what defines a terrorist organization. Let's assume, which of course I'm not saying this is true, but assume that Ethiopia was oppressive. Let's say they were like, Adolf Hitler or something, and that the area, which is now defined as Eritrea, represented a group of people with an affinity that wanted independence. Does their fight for freedom or independence from Ethiopia in that hypothetical, if they use violent means to get independence, does that make them a terrorist organization?
Well, Your Honor, the short answer is that this court in the Khan decision has already said that it does. This is because Congress can be broad or be narrow, be generous or ungenerous when dealing with people seeking admission to the United States. And in this case, Congress has been very narrow and or broad, depending on your perspective, in defining what a terrorist organization is. And there is no exception for freedom fighters. So assuming away the hijacking and the kidnapping of United States persons that the evidence shows the ELF was involved in, assuming that all away and assuming a pure intent to liberate themselves, there's still no exception in the statute for that.
Following up on Judge Gould's question, so is the government saying that if somebody from the eastern part of Libya today rebelling against Gaddafi came into the United States, that person had been involved in the rebel army, that they would be barred based on their terrorism, terrorist activities?
They would be barred, Your Honor, but that's why there is the waiver provision that Congress instituted in 2008.
So the Secretary of Homeland Security, in consultation with the Secretary of State and the Department of Justice, would have the right to waive, otherwise they're toast.
That's correct, Your Honor, and if the person were still in Libya, or not in proceedings yet, the Secretary of State is the one who adjudicates the waiver.
So if we reject all the other claims on the appeal and we say substantial evidence supports what the BIA decided, should we remand as counsel asked us to do so that the BIA can consider the law that lets the Secretary make a waiver, which counsel argued was enacted after after Ms. Haley was before the BIA?
Well, I don't think it would be appropriate for a number of reasons. First, the statute specifies that the court doesn't have jurisdiction over it. Also, it was enacted after the proceedings. Third of all, the board and the immigration judge don't have any jurisdiction over such an issue. The board specifically found that it doesn't. Another reason is because Ms. Haile isn't even eligible right now under any of the waivers that have been put out. Her case was decided in a time before the secretary said she will consider cases. And the fact is that the DHS has also not put out guidance for ELF cases yet. And ultimately,
is it still open to her to apply to the secretary?
Yes, Your Honor.
Procedurally,
the secretary can consider a waiver at any time. So even if this court issues an opinion denying the petition for review, the secretary can still consider a waiver at that time.
So then, if she applied to the secretary, would that stay the BIA's, or would that stay the DHS's removal proceedings, or would it just be like a race of, if the secretary acted before the DHS acted, okay, maybe she'd stay, but if they were too slow, she'd be sent back?
Well, Your Honor, Petitioner's counsel is a good one here, and I think he would go to the district director and ask him to stay pending the consideration of her waiver application. That would Now, the district director would not be required to stay it. Theoretically, the secretary could stay it as well. But that would be one way to prevent that from happening. That's unlikely to happen before the secretary does issue guidance on ELF waiver cases. But once it does, then that would be a possibility.
Okay. Thank you.
There was an issue earlier. I can't.
Well, I had one statutory question in my mind that I thought I'd like to float to you to hear the government's position on. It seems to me here there's some language in the statute that something like a group is a terrorist organization.
Mm-hmm.
It uses like a present tense. And the arguments asserted in the briefing of the petitioner that we should say that means the organization doesn't just have to have been terrorist when the petitioner was in it, but it has to be terrorist as of the date of the hearing that the BIA had. And what I'm trying to understand and can't understand is, how that would work, what the government's position is, if the literal language says is, that let's say KSM got out of Guantanamo Bay and was about to be removed and applied for some type of waiver, and his response to his counsel was, well, yes, but it was found to be not eligible because of a terrorist Al-Qaeda organization. And his response is, yes, they were terrorists last month, but they've now become just a political party. Could the government make proof of the current status of every organization before this bar could apply? And how do you deal with the literal language?
Your Honor, that this actually brings up the issue I was trying to remember before that Judge Smith mentioned. This is one of the things that wasn't raised below, this particular issue. But it is the government's position on the language is the language barring aliens is past tense. It bars an alien who has engaged in terrorist activity from obtaining asylum and withholding. So the language requiring that a terrorist organization engages in terrorist activities, that refers to the activities at the time of the alien's terrorist activities. So it needs to be a terrorist organization at the time the person commits the terrorist activities in support of it. Otherwise, you're looking at a rather bizarre situation where a person could raise funds and materially support a peaceful organization, and for an unrelated reason, the person comes to the United States, applies for asylum. In the meantime, that organization is radicalized and become a terrorist organization. It now is a terrorist organization, and that person did help them. Now that person is barred. So the only way to rationally read that is that the terrorist organization engages in terrorist activities at the time the alien had engaged in those terrorist activities.
Okay, thank you.
Now, the other interesting point about that is, assuming it's correct, Ms. Hiley needs to then show that the evidence compels the conclusion that the ELF is no longer a terrorist organization, because it's her burden to show that the bar to her asylum doesn't apply. And here we have evidence she testified she left the organization in 2002 because it advocated violent overthrow of the government. In 2001, the State Department report described the ELF as an armed opposition group.
Since Eritrea got its independence in, I think it was 91, right?
Yeah, 91 and 93. They're two different events.
So how could the ELF be a separatist terrorist group after they become separate?
Their rival party controls Eritrea right now.
PPLF.
Right. Some members have stayed in opposition and continued the armed struggle, at least as of her testimony in 2002 when she resigned.
You mean they're struggling against Isaias Afwerki's party?
That's correct, Your Honor.
I see. Okay.
So that was one of the other issues where that wasn't raised below. But I suppose we should briefly mention the cap protection issue, because if she's ineligible for asylum, withholding, removal, then she is remains eligible for cap protection. In this case, the board identified a number of issues where a number of suppositions, each of which is not likely to occur, not more than likely to occur, because the standard for obtaining cap is whether the person is more likely than not to be tortured on return to the country of origin. And and her argument is that Mr. Ibrahim threatened her, asked her to marry him, and threatened to reveal her as a member of the ELF if she didn't agree to. And that requires a number of assumptions the board listed.
Traumatic, don't you think?
He sounds like a peach. But starting at the end of the assumptions, the final assumptions that needs to be, that the board said, isn't more likely than not to occur, is that she will be arrested and she will be tortured if she's arrested. One thing we pointed out in the brief is that the government permitted members of the ELF to come back if they renounce the ELF. She's done that explicitly on the record. That was in the Amnesty International report, republished in 2002. Almost 10 years after independence. She's now claims that only applies to immediately after the independence, but again, the record needs to compel that finding. I say I really don't have time to go into this any further.
I think your time is up, Mr. Stone, but we thank you very much for the government's argument.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Co-panelists have other questions. We'll thank you for your presentation, and Mr. Matthew, if you'd like a minute to respond, we'll give that to you.
Thank you. Regarding the exhaustion issue, I would point out that in her brief, she does have two headings saying immigration judge erred in finding that Haile was a member of a terrorist organization, and also erred in finding that Haile engaged in terrorist activities.
What, you have the ER site on that, or AR rather?
54 and 56.
Thank you.
And he details those arguments. So I do believe he did exhaust those arguments. Regarding the hearsay evidence, the counsel noted that the alien often uses hearsay evidence, but that hearsay evidence is not used to prove the case independently, and it can't be used to prove a single issue that wins her whole case, whereas the government here is using hearsay evidence to prove a single material element that basically shuts down the alien's entire case. And I don't believe that's
true. Do we have any authority that we can look at, either from the Supreme Court or from any of the United States Courts of Appeals?
Well,
the country that says hearsay can't be used to establish the element that would be operative on a bar like this.
Well, there is the Sixth Circuit case, which I mentioned, the Muhana, in my brief, and that does say it's regarding the frivolous filing, and the court there does note that the frivolous filing is a death sentence for the alien. So therefore, any evidence provided should be comport with due process and be fundamentally fair. And then there are the other cases that deal with findings of fraud in an immigration case, and similarly. Those are where the Department of State submitted fraud investigation reports with multiple levels of hearsay. And similarly, the courts in those cases have said, we can't accept this type of hearsay because they don't have guarantees of reliability or trustworthiness.
Very good. Thanks. I'm sorry, did you have another question, Judge Gould?
No, I just said thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Matthew. We thank both counsel for their arguments. The case of Haile versus Holder is submitted.